What's up, y'all? Kelly Clarkson with Wayfair. My favorite thing about the holidays? Decking out my whole house. It's not a competition, but if it was, well, I'd win the season with Wayfair. Outdoor inflatable Santa? Got it on Wayfair. Trees, lights, and ornaments? Wayfair. Hosting must-haves like dining sets, beds, sheets, and towels? Wayfair. For everything in your style delivered with fast and free shipping, visit Wayfair.com or the Wayfair app to win the season. But again, it's not a competition.
Wayfair, every style, every home.
Hi, folks. Welcome to another episode of Film Study. This is Ken McKusick, and we have a short for you tonight on the integrity of the game in face of more and more gambling and more conspiracies and also actual events that seem to be unraveling before us. Joining us to talk about that is Alan Frankel. Alan, how you doing?
I'm doing great today, Ken. Really excited to talk about this topic.
Yeah. I've long been one who said that it's very difficult to maintain the integrity of the game. But football's actually had an active hand in building more of a gambling culture around sports. It's certainly always been popular in terms of football. It's been one of the most heavily wagered upon sports, other than maybe football, soccer. It's probably the most worldwide. But it's always been a popular part of the game. Now the owners have made it easier to gamble, even on site in a lot of cases, right at the ballpark with FanDuel windows and whatever else they may have there. They may or may not have direct relationships with gambling, but they certainly have gambling as very much a close ally of the sport.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, it generates so much fan interest. It generates a lot of stakes for fans. Even if you're a fan of a team, it can be a way to even hedge your bets on your own team. If you're nervous that your team's going to lose, you bet on the other side. Maybe, you know, you win the game, you're happy. You win some money, you're happy. I've heard that's the popular fan hedge. But I think that one of the things that drives football's popularity with gamblers is actually the scoring system, how you can make up 14 points really fast. Whereas in basketball, it could take, you know, 7, 8 to 10 possessions to make up a 20-point lead. Football, you get a touchdown, you get a quick fumble. Suddenly, you know, the game's back in reach. And I think that that's actually one of the core elements to it that I think really makes the sport go.
It certainly is one of the things that have made the game interesting, period. Forget the gambling side for a minute. Just having games that are fairly close. And part of why close games occur is because of the function of second half football. Is you have one team who's trying like hell to catch up and the other team's trying to kill the clock and get the game over with. And so it's actually the clock itself plays a role in keeping games close that I don't think that fans always are hip to, but it certainly is something that games are played for expected wins. They're not played for expected points. And that's something in the second half, I think, that is not completely embraced by people who analyze the game always.
Yeah, I can tell you that I actually have a very, very good football board game that I play. And one thing I've noticed is that it gets very different when you're the one in the headset. You generally run the offense, you run the defense, you coordinate the coverages, and you start to see all of a sudden with 14 point leads, you know, in real time, people who maybe would say, I got to be more aggressive with coaches to their own team, suddenly will go back into those two deep shell coverages that they claim to hate. So I've had the experience with people who, you know, they'll say one thing and then I tell them, look, come in the headset. You're going to make the calls this game. Suddenly they have a slightly different tune. Once they've earned that 14 point lead and they've had to put the work in to get it, they're a little bit more prone to going more prevent, more preserve once they've earned it.
All right. Well, certainly it's true on both sides of the ball. You can play conservatively to try and hold the lead. But let's get back to the gambling topic here for a minute. You know, obviously, the NFL, a lot of their popularity is built on the fact that people love to wager on football. And it's more than any other sport. Hockey doesn't have that kind of a following. Baseball doesn't. And that's why the recent events are so weird. Baseball did. Back in the 19-teens, the culture of gambling in the United States reached an unbelievable height. Well, I'm sure we'll get back to that later, that culminated in the 1919 World Series getting fixed. But that doesn't exist anymore. I mean, not in the same way. But the introduction of the ability to bet online at any point in time, including on individual pitches, which is the most ridiculous thing I've ever heard of. The Class A and Ortiz thing is ridiculous on so many levels, but you start with the fact that people are betting on individual pitches, and the gambling establishment, the organization that loses money on those pitches, has every incentive to turn those players into their own leagues. and you know, enormous sums of money were wagered, not just on those pitches, but on the rest of their careers of those two pitchers who I am sure will never pitch another, throw another major league pitch.
So you're hitting on a couple of interesting points. I'm going to go after them one by one and bring up the also the NBA, what just happened with Terry Rozier and Chauncey Billups. And in some ways, you know, Terry Rozier kind of is the symptom of someone like Chauncey Billups. And, you know, we talk about the risk reward. It seems a little strange that players who could have, you know, multi-million serious contracts, real generational wealth, are willing to put it on the line, you know, for, you know, certain gambling incentives. It feels a little counterintuitive. So how does that happen? And then when you look at kind of Chauncey Billups and his alleged, this is all alleged, innocent until proven guilty, alleged involvement with mafias, gambling rings, and putting players in compromised situations through rigged poker games, very easy to see how something could go south pretty quick. I'm going to say two different examples that are potential problems. The first one is that a player is down a large amount of money in a short period of time due to a rigged gambling casino. We know that did happen. There was a rigged casino that Billups was involved in. Did he know about it? We don't know. But there was a rigged casino. So that could be a way for players to very quickly put on a lot of debt on themselves that suddenly they can't, you know, they can't, you know, make good on. And then they have to do things like manipulate pitches and things like that, like what Classe was involved in. The next thing, right, it's a problem, is insider information. You get a bunch of athletes in a room, casinos, beer, alcohol starts flowing, maybe other things going on. Suddenly it's an environment where, hey, can you tell me if a guy's sitting or starting next week? Or in the NBA, especially where players are volatile game to game, are they playing? Are they injured? What's the game plan? You know, suddenly insider information can leak. And to me, when I think about Classe, I actually think that, you know, Classe and Rozier are kind of the symptoms of what happens when you have a ring like what Billups was allegedly involved in.
Well, let's stick with Classe for a second rather than talk about the general symptomization here. Classe is a guy who's making millions of dollars per year, and I don't know the exact amount. Maybe he makes 8 million, 10 million, 15 million. I'm not sure what, but he's the closer for the Guardians. I mean, obviously is a player who should think very seriously about all his future earnings with regard to that. Most people in banking who work in casinos, who work anywhere around money, who, you know, athletes in basically almost any other situation are so careful. They understand their future earnings are pretty much what they have. Their reputation fuels all of that. It's exactly correct. If you steal from a casino, if you have some confidence scheme to beat them, you won't work around money again. It's not just for a casino. You really won't get a job around money again. And the amount of money that he's making, it should provide some level of insulation for this kind of blatant stupidity in terms of you know, being talked into something like this. I don't know what his defense is going to be. I mean, he's going to stand trial for this. He may actually do jail time along with Ortiz. But, you know, I wonder, you know, what's he going to say? Whereas you look back to 1919, players were making, you know, very little compared to the common working man in those days, not much more. It used to be for a long time. It was basically professional athletes make about seven times the working wage. And now it's many times that. Did that additional money, that additional insulation, all the additional money we paid for advertising buy us nothing in terms of integrity?
So that's a little bit of where I was going. It's that there's some sort of negative event, and sometimes it's nothing to do with, you know, anything. Sometimes somebody has something bad happened in a family, just a tragedy or something that they can't afford to handle. That's a natural occurrence. But what I think happens to a lot of these players is they do end up in an unfortunate situation that they didn't foresee, whether it's a debt or they gave information and suddenly somebody has, you know, blackmail. Something they could hang over their heads, blackmail. like, I think that unfortunately these players do get entrapped in these situations. And I know that the NFL specifically, they do have people come out. I believe I've seen even, I think it was Herm Edwards talks about it in one of his, just 20 years ago, he did a speech on it before rookie players and things like that. So I know that they do have some things to try. And I know that the old players do try to be a resource for these guys, but sometimes players just get trapped. And I think that for a person like Class A, I don't know, you know, maybe he'll end up being either found guilty or not guilty, but I think more likely he's going to probably have to settle in exchange for other information. Potentially it's a dark road to go down. I honestly, I too am curious as to what caused Class A to get there. And I don't think we'll like what we find out.
It's possible. It's possible he could have debts. It's still relative future earnings relative to current debt. I mean, I can't even imagine, you know, how serious that would have to be for him to feel like he had to sacrifice himself for this process. It's you know, honestly, you look all across society, it's much more likely that somebody's disadvantaged, you know, economically is going to commit a crime. It's the nature of the world that people are more desperate when they aren't doing well in life. It's just not the case with Class A. It's really not. There's no excuse for it. And it was so heinously stupid in terms of traceability that, I mean, it's like the worst form of insider trading. It's like you heard about the RJR Nabisco breakup, and all of a sudden you bought, you know, a million shares of it 3 days before anything was announced. I mean, is that bad in terms of the flagrancy? Because, you know, extreme bets like this are going to be reported to the league directly. And I'm at a loss for the stupidity of the whole thing.
It's Bud Fox level, for those familiar with the movie Wall Street. It's a Bud Fox thing where, like, eventually they're going to catch you if you keep being on the right side of so many of these trades. But one thing that I think one point you've brought up, which I think is interesting, is that all the people that are getting caught are all people that it seemed like were taking money from the casino. It was not about, you know, maybe the casinos maybe having some insider information on events. It's all people who would have ended up taking from the casinos. It's not the casinos getting caught or individual thing maybe having a tip on some of the games. So, you know, the house always wins, and it looks like, once again, the house is going to once again walk away. And I think that a lot of people have some mistrust towards the casinos themselves about if they have any information leaning towards which lines are going to win and which ones won't. But all of the cases right now are all, you know, people who are trying to win money from casinos. There was a big bubble of betting activity around otherwise relatively quiet props, and then they were caught because of that, all of a lot of props going in a very short period of time, or specific concentration of activity. Like you said, it's, if you looked on the chart, you know, you mentioned some Wall Street analysts. I personally work at a bank. You know, you would have seen this, the bubble went from, you know, up from a very small bubble in terms of concentration to a very large bubble, and would be like, well, what happened here? Well, suddenly those bets all lost, and it, you know, it wouldn't take long to trigger an anomalous investigation.
We'd take seconds to figure out exactly what's going on. You know, it's certain people betting these amounts, certain accounts, and, you know, they've got limits in terms of how far they can do it. And then you find out they're Dominican accounts, and, oh, the pitcher's Dominican. It's not too hard to put the pieces together in terms of, you know, what happened. You may not have every attachment all the way through there in terms of how the communications went, but
I'm just imagining Inspector Clouseau somehow coming to the wrong conclusion here.
It does make sense also that the gambling institution, I'm not saying they're above reproach in this case, but their whole business is built on integrity of their games being, you know, what it needs to be. They know well enough that they can't afford to be thought a cheater, or they'll lose most of their customers in a heartbeat. Anyway, the Class A thing, just ridiculous. You wanted to talk a little bit about the Donaghy situation, the Western Conference Finals, I know, from 2002.
I'd say my favorite thing about the Donaghy situation was that, if you were a fan at the time, you know, the Lakers and the Kings, Lakers, obviously big market team, marquee NBA franchise, Kings, not necessarily a bottom feeder, but definitely nowhere near the cachet of your Celtics and your Lakers. And I think that, you know, a lot of people pointed out that there was poor officiating throughout the series, and everybody said they were wrong. Everybody said, you're sour grapes. You just lost your sour grapes. And, you know, it turned out that they were wrong and that there was issues going on in the NBA. So I think that the reason why I'm bringing this up is because I'm somebody who's, you know, a little critical. Sometimes I try to follow the money. Money sometimes can lead you to interesting places, especially when you have big money, stadium, NFL stadium deals, a lot of things of that nature have definitely caught my attention, labor agreements. So when you have those types of situations, when people have maybe a alternative theory, don't necessarily, when you're having a conversation with those people, you don't have to think they're crazy right off the bat. Maybe they're seeing something that you haven't previously considered. And maybe they're only going to be right 5 to 8% of the time. But just for a second, take a breath and say, you know what? Maybe I need to look at that game and say, maybe there was something off. Maybe I should take another look at it.
Well, I'll say that is exactly what happened in the 1919 World Series. But there was an incredible amount of talk in advance about what had happened in that one. And so when the series actually happened, people already kind of had the feeling this series was about to be thrown by the White Sox, in that case, to the Reds. It was a pre-conspiracy theory as opposed to a post-conspiracy theory. And they had too many mouths that couldn't keep them, that couldn't stay shut. And too much money changing hands, frankly, in a short period of time. Too many losers who were incented to talk after the fact. And they still never got the guys convicted, which would have been, you know, a real win for baseball to clean itself up in that way. But they did get them thrown out of the game by Commissioner Landis after the 1920 season. But I did want to say this. That wasn't the end of it. I think there were 22 players from that era who were thrown out. And in fact, one of them could have been Ty Cobb, who is supposedly through the last game or was involved in.
Let me tell you about the online cannabis company that's changing the game, Mood.com. They created an entirely line of functional gummies, 100% federally legal THC blends, discreetly delivered right to your doorstep. And here's the best part. You can get 20% off your first order at Mood.com with the promo code Ravens. Now, I've tried a bunch of their gummies myself. Each one's totally unique. The Sleepy Time gummies knock me out right away. They help me unwind fast, leave me refreshed the next morning. The Epic Euphoria gummies, they're perfect for when your day just isn't going the way you want it to go. What makes Mood special is how they pair the THC with natural herbs and adaptogens. You won't find blends like this at any local shop. They've got gummies designed for focus, relaxation, clarity, even energy, all made from cannabis grown on small, family-owned American farms. No pesticides, no shortcuts, just high-quality weed you can trust. Plus, Mood backs everything with a 100-day satisfaction guarantee. So head on over to Mood.com, check out their amazing selection, and don't forget to use the promo code Ravens at checkout to save 20% off your first order.
Many supplements on the market are hard to absorb or packed with fillers. But that's not the case with Quiksilver Scientific. Quiksilver Scientific is a U.S.-based company that manufactures advanced liposomal supplements, making nutrients easier for your body to absorb and put to work quickly. Made in Colorado in an NSF GMP-certified facility and rigorously tested, this is science-first supplementation. After adding Ultravitamin into my routine, recovery feels faster and I don't hit that midday crash anymore. Trusted worldwide for supplements that truly make a difference in performance, resilience, and well-being. Quiksilver Scientific makes advanced liposomal supplements so you can actually feel the difference. Energy, focus, calm, recovery. Get 10% off plus free shipping at tryqs.com/podcast. That's tryqs.com/podcast. These statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease.
Hey, what's up, y'all? Kelly Clarkson with Wayfair. My favorite thing about the holidays? Decking out my whole house. It's not a competition, but if it was, well, I'd win the season with Wayfair. Outdoor inflatable Santa? Got it on Wayfair. Trees, lights, and ornaments? Wayfair. Hosting must-haves like dining sets, beds, sheets, and towels? Wayfair. For everything in your style delivered with fast and free shipping, visit Wayfair.com or the Wayfair app to win the season. But again, it's not a competition.
Wayfair, every style, every home.
Shopify is a global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business and sell more with less effort thanks to the Shopify Magic, your AI-powered all-star. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/redcircle, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/redcircle now to grow your business, no matter what stage you're in. Shopify.com/redcircle.
In setting up throwing the last game in the 1923 season. I bring that up in a relative sense because that was 4 years after, and the gambling culture is so still so prevalent in the United States that there was an appetite for this. It's like, have we learned nothing? It's what keeps coming up in this. You know, we have a Hall of Famer for, you know, in Pete Rose, who's, you know, barred from the game for life and, you know, had to die for him to, basically be reinstated kind of thing in a sense. But, you know, what do you, there seems to be no limit to it.
There seems to be no limit to it. And, you know, we're a football, this is, you know, generally a football show. And I can tell you that certain things from the league is also what causes these things. And sometimes it's strange decisions from a coach, like the Browns not kicking a field goal from the 29-yard line, electing to punt against the Raiders when it was right on the point spread. And maybe it was just Stefanski didn't want to humiliate the other team for an extra 3 points. Simple explanation. But when you have gambling, everything goes through the frame of gambling. So when you have two teams, like the, I think it was maybe it was Eagles-Packers, that Monday Night Football didn't have a lot of points. Two teams, Monday Night Football, people were expecting there to be some decent offensive fireworks. Everything suddenly gets framed through gambling. It changes the fans' frame. And it's not only is it addictive, it's a rush for the fans. It gives them so much stakes that the level of focus on the game becomes really close. And I think that focus and that level of stakes is what's bringing fans into gambling, and they just don't quit. For me personally, I enjoyed doing it every once in a while. Out of sports gamble, I've since stopped because I realized it was just something that was taking up too much of my life. But one thing I will tell you is that in the NFL, you have refs like John Hussey who have tremendous home favoritism, home bias, and the gamblers are onto it. And to tell you one thing, last week, people were talking to me about Chiefs Cowboys. The minute I saw Hussey was on that game, I said, oh, we might be in for something with this Chiefs-Cowboys game that the Cowboys are going to have an advantage. And they did. And there's been a few games which I've brought up. I know we talked about the Smith for the AFC title game. Since Smith has been a little bit more 50-50, it was a small sample, so I'm not going to go into that. But Warren Sharp puts out really great stats. Hussey is for sure someone who's there. He's roughing Colts-Jaguars today. That's this week. That's one to take a look at. You know, and the reason why it's a problem is that the NBA, in my opinion, did a good job. They put out something called the two-minute report. Two-minute report goes through every single possible call in the last 2 minutes of an NBA game, and there's accountability at least for those final elements of the game. And they at least did something to show accountability. The NFL has variances by crew. It has, you know, variance home and road, how teams are officiated. And to be honest, the rule book has only gotten thicker, roughing the passer. What's pass interference? Ken, one thing I wanted to kind of pose to you as a question, just a fun question. If I showed you three random plays, and let's say I wasn't trying to be particularly nice, and I said, which of these three plays, I didn't tell you how many, which of these three plays got pass interference calls? How well, do you think you'd consistently score well on that test?
Not if you're handpicking the plays, I wouldn't. If it was from a cross-section of all NFL plays that somebody on TV mentioned that pass interference could have been called, then I think I'd do very well. But if you're handpicking the plays, no, I don't think I'd do well.
I think because
you'd pick counter to the obvious.
I was saying if I picked plays that I felt like were average, you know, 50-50 type of plays, I don't feel confident that I would score very well on them. And when I talk about penalties with my friends now, I've kind of adopted a different language where I'll say that's like a 65 percentile pass interference. So like Zay Flowers' interference the other weekend, I'll be mm-hmm. like, people say, ooh, I'm upset about the call. I don't like the call, yes or no. And I kind of think that calls are kind of on a spectrum. Yep. And, you know, so I said Zay Flowers' PI was somewhere in 65% range where it could get called 6 out of 10, 6 and a half out of 10. People are sending me videos, well, here's a play where Hopkins pushed off and he didn't get the call, or somebody else pushed off on a different play more egregiously and didn't get the call. Personally, I actually did a video on the fourth down plays for the Lions and the Eagles. In the Lions-Eagles game, the Lions had 4 or 5 failures on Sunday Night Football. Obviously, it reopened the fourth down conversation, going for it, not going for it. But one thing that I saw was that there was a fourth down play where there was a pretty egregious illegal contact on the targeted receiver, and it did not get flagged. And then later in the game, there was a 50-50 call on the Lions that ended up, you know, keeping the ball away from the Lions to get a tying drive at the end of the game. And I can tell you that just between those two plays and that snapshot, I was like, I don't know what to expect from this league. So I can only say things on a percentile level, and they don't come out and say, we got this one right, we got this one wrong. And I'm going to tell you why I think they do that. and why the NFL getting in bed with Vegas is a very interesting partnership. Vegas is centered upon the fact that you almost won. Lemon. You don't win. When fans can blame the refs for losing, they're not blaming their teams. They're like, oh, we could have won. We could have done this if we just would have gotten that call. And it invents this sort of near win fallacy. And when I think about the NFL getting in bed with Vegas, the professionals of the near win fantasy, that's something that, you know, it gets my eyebrows raised. I'm like, what's going on here? It's an interesting situation.
Okay. All right. I can understand that. Certainly that is, they're exactly a group that would want to do that. I hate using the term Vegas to describe somebody. I mean, people do generally understand what it means. The gambling establishment, the people who are setting lines, the people who are doing that. It's us. We set the lines, you know, largely speaking, because that line is dollar weighted. It's not count of idiot weighted. So, you know, it's one of the problems I have with what's going to happen to lines in 2026 is if the current tax law goes into effect as it's stated to be. And by the way, I don't believe that's going to survive the year, folks. I don't believe the only 90% of losses are deductible is going to survive this this year and be in place in 2026. But if that does go into place, it'll make gambling less efficient as a predictive market. The gambling markets will be less predictive because you'll have to win that much more as a sharp in order to break even. I think there will always be a number of people who are willing to gamble and lose their money, even though they know they have an advantage, a disadvantage that's so large they can't overcome. There will always be people who want to bet football, even under those circumstances. If you really had it mapped out for you under the new tax law, it would scare the living bejesus out of you in terms of how bad the situation is. You go from at a 30% marginal tax rate, you go from 52.38%, a well-known figure, 11/21st, to 53.88%. You have to get right, and that is an Everest-sized mountain to climb in terms of additional required win probability.
So I am familiar with the tax law. I was actually reading up on it about 6 months ago. I read up on it. I'm trying to remember exactly when it's played. But when I read that, I was like, they just think that people are hopelessly addicted to this. Or it's some people are just betting such small amounts of money, 10, 15 bucks each week. They're not thinking about the tax ramifications. And they just don't see it. I can tell you that, like, just like you're saying, like, you know, you think you can beat the house. I think I'm a relatively sharp fan. And I can tell you that can't do it. And then at that tax, you know, with that rule, you really can't do it.
And there's even more. I mean, you have asymmetric taxation in the United States. So you don't, your wins get taxed, but your losses aren't deductible or carry forwardable the way your losses are on stocks. So it's a unreasonable tax system to start with. And then most other countries, by the way, gambling winnings are not even taxed. But I think, Alan, you don't have to worry about it because it was done for political reasons. I don't think anybody thought what you just said. I think they thought basically we can show a way that this big, beautiful bill is $8 billion less in terms of inflating the national debt than it otherwise would be. We'll put this in there with no intention to enforce it because we put it in a way that can't possibly be enforced. It's just too heinously stupid in terms of what somebody might have to do in terms of defining what constitutes an individual bet. I mean, literally, I mean, if I'm at a blackjack table and I'm betting hand after hand, am I supposed to write down every single hand that I have in exchange? Because every single discrete outcome in theory would be taxable and deductible at only 90%. Am I supposed to do it at the session level? Because that's the only level at which the casino will have records. Well, maybe. Am I supposed to do it at the trip level? Because that's the level I keep my records. I know how much money I went with. I know how much money I came back with. I don't really know on an individual, you know, casino basis. So it's not enforceable as is, which is one of the reasons why it's going to be killed. But the reason it was put in there at all in the beginning, I'm 95% sure, was political entirely, is to try and make the bill more palatable to a few marginal Republican people who are voting on it.
Well, Ken, I've got a lot of experience with ambiguous rules, having watched the NFL officiate roughing the passer. But I just want to, you know, bring up one small tidbit of something that may have come out of it recently. For anybody who watched the Bengals-Steeler game, the Bengals, before the half, committed 3 roughing the passer calls, I think in one drive. and eventually injuring Aaron Rodgers, which obviously has consequence for our upcoming game this week. Eventually injuring Aaron Rodgers. And now listen, I'm not claiming bounty. I'm not going to make any outlandish claim like that. But what I do think happened was the Bengals realized we don't know what roughing the passer is. They can call it at any time. We're just going to hit him. If we have to live with the price, we have to live with the price. And when you have ambiguous rules, then you can kind of weaponize that, because if it's just a random, you know, every 10% of time, every 15%, then we're going to incur it. We can't prevent ourselves from incurring it. So
right.
we might as well get That's the upside true. Of physically hitting the quarterback. And I was watching that game live, and I saw Rodgers get hit and get hit and get hit. And I said, I don't think he's going to survive the afternoon, because the Bengals just don't care about incurring these fouls. And I thought the Bengals had a point. I thought, we don't really know how it's officiated, so we're just going to live with it. And it ended up knocking him out of the game and potentially impacting the rest of the Steelers season in a pretty large way.
I don't know how a game like football, which is coincidentally violent and open in terms of movement. So what I'm talking about with this, you can describe baseball in a state space way very simply. I can define baseball as having 25 states for base and out situations, for example. The only other sport I'm aware of that's that like discernible of in terms of states is bowling. You know, in terms of, you know, your what yeah. pins you have standing, which ball, that you can replicate that in a model pretty quickly. So baseball has been always fairly model about that. And that's there's plenty of other free movement in baseball, don't get me wrong, but there's a whole bunch of constrained movement which limits your things. Now, football, yeah, they have a field, but you're as long as you stay on it, you're the ball's still in play, and it just makes, they need to have rules to try and prevent injury, and they need to have rules to try and manage the activity that's going on the field. Already the rule book is, if you've ever taken a look at it, is an absolutely enormous and virtually unreadable entity. And it's out there now. If you look on, I think it's on GSIS, but it's on some other places too. NFL operations has it, where you can look at it. I mean, I challenge you, this thing, this is something I looked up, and it took me about 2 hours of going through this before I could figure out exactly what was going on. But a blocked kick that goes out of bounds directly off a block, where is that ball placed for the ensuing possession? And try and figure that out reading the rule book. I'm not going to tell you what the answer is. Go back and try and read for yourself and see if you can figure it out. It is extraordinarily complicated.
Wow. that's an interesting question. Maybe I'll have the answer next time I'm on your show. Answer for you.
Yeah. All right. Let's see. Anything else we want to talk about before we get going here?
I'd say one more thing I want to talk about, especially with NFL games, is I hear people say that this team was quote unquote more disciplined just by looking at how many penalties were incurred. And, you know, just mapping the game out a little bit. You know, let's say there's about 153 plays, I think, in an NFL game, roughly 11 interactions. You know, you have 11 interactions per team. So let's say for any given team, you just look at 11 times, you know, 153, that gets you 1683 in total interactions for a game. That's just one interaction per player. There could be more. So if you have five penalties, that's like 0.00 something. If you have seven penalties, you're still in 0.00 something. So aside from the fact that penalty calls can be correct or incorrect, just saying that your team is more disciplined because you had more or less penalties, it's kind of a rounding error. And that's something which I hear people talk about with different teams, whether it was the Patriots dynasty or other things, that this team is more disciplined. In my opinion, the only way to really track that as an idea is you have to look at every team, look at all the potential penalties that happen in a game, of which I've never heard someone do. Perhaps there's somebody who has done it. I have not heard it. But I would love to see somebody see how many potential penalties a team could have had. You know, plays that could have been like 50%, like we talked about percentile wise, and then say, okay, they got called for this amount, but they actually committed a lot more penalties. So really, you know, one team really could have been more disciplined than the other. It's just something that I thought was interesting when fans bring up the more disciplined argument. I just don't think it's been ever fully thought through.
Right. I mean, I don't disagree with you anyway on the topic, but one thing I'd say is start trimming the fat pretty quickly if you're trying to model that, and take out like false start penalties, for example. I mean, they're fairly cut and dried in terms of what I'm not saying there's not one occasionally that will go the wrong way, like we saw happen. What game was it that was in the last Ravens game, right? That Falele and Rosengard supposedly both moved, but Murphy was already in the neutral zone.
I just immediately think of the Chiefs when I think of people jumping offside. So I don't remember. As a matter of fact, I don't think the Ravens have ever committed a false start since I've started watching games.
All right, Alan. Great talking football with you again. Tell folks where they can talk to you online if they'd like to.
Sure. So you can find me on Twitter, FrankSports21, frequently replying to Ken's tweets. I always enjoy our dialogue. And you can find me on the Kickoff Podcast on Spotify. And I'm on DCAll22's Discord. I'm pretty active there, so you can find me there too.
All right. All right. Very cool. All22, definitely content I would highly recommend. Other folks out there, please make use of hashtag Film Study Mailbag when you can. Trying to do more short videos around that. So if you have a question you think I can answer in between 1 and 3 minutes, I'd love to hear it from you. That's kind of 3 minutes, about the maximum length of a video that I can put out there on Twitter. I could put out longer, but it just wouldn't, people wouldn't watch it as frequently. But I appreciate it if your questions come in that way. And if the question is longer, still might be a great question. We'll try and get incorporated into one of the shows. Alan, thanks again for coming on.
No problem. Always great to be here, Ken.
I'll talk to you next time on Film Study.